Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back, and today we are taking a break from counting down our favorite 100 movies of all time. And we are going to talk about 2021 just as a whole. This was a crazy year of movie watching for John and I both. I actually hit my 365th movie yesterday on December 27th. So I hit 365 earlier than the end of the year. I got halfway through The Spy Who Loved Me last night and then fell asleep. Not because I didn't love it, just because it's that relaxing and that pleasant of a movie. But I will be above 365 for the year. So John and I figured, hey, why not sit down and kind of do a year in review of the movies we watched, some movies from 2021, but we're going to be talking about just movies as a whole throughout the year, considering we were all over the spectrum watching movies from literally every era and every genre. It didn't matter. And here we are today on December 28th. So, John, welcome in. What's going on?
Not a whole lot. I have surpassed 365 movies now. I'm up to 376 watches on the year. Only 360 of them are unique movies. I've rewatched a few this year, so I've got to get five more in by the end of Friday night. But it looks like I'm going to be hitting that 365 as well.
So you didn't hit? How have you not hit 365 yet?
So I've watched 376 movies, but I've rewatched 16 movies this year. So I watched them twice this year. I got to watch another five to get to that 365 unique movies in the year.
Oh, so that it says it. Yeah, I have two more I have to do to get that on Letterboxd, which I will do. Probably get one out of the way right after this podcast. Yeah. And then get another one in, I'm sure, over the last 3 days of this year. But yeah, mine says 363, even though I know that I've watched 365. I know I rewatched Wild Strawberries. I don't know what the other rewatch movie is, and that's confusing me. I don't think it counted the Muppet Haunted Mansion movie, which doesn't make sense to me because on Letterboxd, it says anything longer than 40 minutes counts as a movie. And that movie's like 49 minutes long. Like, that movie's up there with like Silent Film Chaplin. So like, yeah. I don't understand why it's not counting it. And I even like deleted it and then reposted it and it's still not counting it. So I don't know. I give up. But I'm sure I'll still get two movies in anyway and it won't really matter all that much. But John, the categories that we're going to be hitting today, and I'm not going to read them in the order. We're actually going to announce them. But I'll do that after. We're going to be doing our best for five first watches this year. So it doesn't matter what year the movie came out. It's just the best five first watches, a movie we hadn't seen before that we watched this year. Top five movies. We're going to talk about our most disappointing movie that we watched this year. We're going to talk about the biggest pleasant surprise movie that we watched this year. We're going to talk about a movie that wasn't as good as we remembered that we watched this year. We're going to talk about a movie that was way better than we remembered that we watched this year. We're going to talk about the worst movie that we watched this year. We're going to talk about the worst movie of 2021. And we're going to give our top five movies of 2021 as well. And I will say this right off the bat. I still have not taken the time to watch The Power of the Dog. So that could maybe potentially jump into my top five. But I just want that to be known, because I do know that right now that is looking like the Oscar favorite at the time, Jane Campion's movie, which I'll throw in now. If you have watched that and you're looking for another one of her movies, go watch The Piano. It is stellar. Holly Hunter doesn't talk. Harvey Keitel's naked for most of the movie, but it is still a very, very good movie. John, how are you feeling about this? And how do you think I'm going to do with actually remembering the order we discussed pre-show?
I'm feeling great. We've watched a ton of movies, so there's a lot of things to discuss this year. We'll see about the order. We'll see what happens. I haven't written down an order, so we'll go for it.
Well, let's see how long we can get before John says, Phil, that's not what you told me. But I do remember that we're going to start it off with the worst movie of 2021, right? That is where we're going to start. This is a 2021 year in review. I will admit, I didn't watch that many movies from 2021, which kind of surprised me. I thought that I would have seen more, but I guess I was spending so much time trying to play catch up on movies and like watch a lot of, like Oscar winners, Oscar nominees, going through the Studio Ghibli movies, which I haven't watched Earwig and the Witch, and I'm sure that's going to be a fucking doozy. But the worst movie of 2021, what was it for you, John?
So I've seen about 20 or so 2021 movies, which isn't a lot in the grand scale of things, but I narrowed it down pretty quickly to three blockbuster movies that released this year. I was considering Godzilla vs. Kong, but it kind of got the edge out of being a little bit better because it's still a Godzilla movie.
Yeah, it's not that bad.
But I am going to give it to Zack Snyder's Justice League, the most unnecessary 4-hour long piece of garbage I have ever watched.
Yeah, that's going to make a lot of people mad, John, but that's why we bring you on these things, so that you can make people mad and I can just keep saying stuff that will ultimately make people a little bit less mad, because I don't watch garbage like that, because I knew that I would hate that movie. But what is it about that movie that just puts it down there at the very bottom, other than the fact that it's 4 hours long?
It's a lot of things. It's the unnecessariness of it. Like, I get, we finally get, it's great seeing a studio acknowledge that, like, a director that they then changed directors halfway through and recut the film, and they wanted to re-release this movie in the original director's vision. But just all of those, like, Warner Brothers current, like, Justice League movies and all of their, like, individual films have been so bad. And bringing them all together just kind of shows how flawed everything is. So while, yes, it tells a bit more of a cohesive story than Joss Whedon's original edit did, it's so there's just so much unnecessary things added to the film that it's like Zack Snyder in his always Zack Snyderness decided that you needed like 30% of the film to be in slow motion. And it's like, this movie is 2 hours longer than it needs to be because half of it is slowed down to half speed.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I don't want to watch it at all, and I'm glad I haven't watched it yet. And yeah, that's probably another part of the reason why I watch so few movies this year, because I don't watch superhero movies. Now, the one that I'm going to go with, I will preface this with, you should all still go watch it, because it comes very close to the so bad it's good, but it doesn't hit it for me. And John, I know you actually gave it a pretty decent review. But I go with Willy's Wonderland. It's like kind of like a cult type movie. Nicolas Cage just going crazy and, you know, killing animatronics and stuff like that. For me, it just didn't get to where it needed to get. And so for that reason, I put it as the worst movie this year. Again, it kind of comes down to the fact that I really didn't watch that many movies this year. Unfortunately, I think I'm only at like 20 or so. But this was the only one that I was like, oof. However, there's some people who are going to sit down and watch this and say, ah, that's so bad, it's good. So it has like a pretty decent 2.7 for this kind of movie on IMDb, or I'm sorry, on Letterboxd. Might be worth checking out. Nicolas Cage doesn't talk the entire movie, so there's always something good going on there. Another one that really bothered me that I didn't end up putting there because it's more of a documentary and whatever, was that What Happened Brittany Murphy thing. I actually like, I was very interested in that because of one of my bosses. He had like known Brittany Murphy and stuff. So I was like, ooh, I wonder if like that, man, that was a waste of a documentary. Like what a waste of time. It doesn't do anything. It tries to be a true crime thing. And it's like Brittany Murphy's been dead for almost 20 years and everybody knows that like she wasn't murdered. So what are we doing here? But I'll go with Willy's Wonderland, but I still say you should check it out if you feel the desire or the need to check it out. It's definitely not over long the way Justice League is, so there is hope for that one. And, John, no, I actually did the first one in the right order.
I know, and Willy's Wonderland was actually one of the movies I watched twice this year.
Nice!
I watched it when it first came out with just my roommate, and then we had a few people over later in the year, and we're like, okay, we should watch this movie together. It's a fun movie. Like, is it good? No. The acting outside of Nicolas Cage is atrocious. And I mean, we always have,
which is crazy because Beth Grant is in it. And I just claimed how great Beth Grant was a couple days ago.
I know. But, and we still have that question of whether or not Nicolas Cage is great or not. But like seeing him in this silent role, you see Nick Cage there and you're like, oh, he's going to be like, he's the lead of the film. And we're going to like find out so much. He's going to be talking the entire time. And then just have him in this silent role the entire time, gyrating up against a pinball machine for half the movie. It's beautiful in the only the way that Nicolas Cage can make a movie beautiful.
Yeah. I hear you, man. I hear you. Nick Cage is something else. All right, we're going to stick with the negativity here, and we're going to go to what was the most disappointing movie you watched this year? And it could be, this is a movie from any year. This isn't a 2020-21 movie. What is the most disappointing movie you watched this year?
The most disappointing movie I watched this year was Sam Raimi's Drag Me to Hell. And I think a lot of it,
to hear.
I think a lot of it came up to how much it had kind of been, it's been really hyped up in movie circles over the last few years. That's like this cult classic that everyone kind of skipped over. It came out in the late aughts. So it had been past that moment where Sam Raimi had been like, had the Spider-Man and like, started bringing over the Japanese horror with The Grudge. And it was kind of passed over at the time. And people always talk about how fantastic it is. But what I found with it was that it really didn't mix the horror and the comedy as well as Sam Raimi's other products did, like The Evil Dead, which are both, like the first two Evil Dead movies are both in my top 100. I love Sam Raimi films. But Drag Me to Hell, it's almost goofy, but not intentionally goofy. And it just, it's a fine line it's trying to walk, and it teeters to either side every once in a while.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember that coming out and everybody being really excited about it. I love the ending. I think the ending is very, very funny. Like the ending is just so like messed up and out there. And so I really did enjoy the ending. But I agree with you. It's a pretty forgettable Sam Raimi movie, which is, a weird thing to say, because even his bad movies, such as Spider-Man 3, you still remember a lot of that movie. Like, because there's so much, like, he just has such a distinct style that even when he's bad or off, it's still memorable. I don't really remember anything from Drag Me to Hell except the ending. And that's saying a lot from a Sam Raimi movie.
Yeah, it also felt like oddly paced. It's really slow to get started. And then it's kind of just over. And it's like, oh, okay, I guess that's the movie. It was weird, but it was enjoyable still. Like, it wasn't a bad movie per se. It just wasn't a good movie per se.
Yeah, yeah. I hear it. And hey, that's what disappointing is all about. And that's why we're kind of mixing this up as we go. My most disappointing one was My Neighbor Totoro. The Studio Ghibli movie. That movie gets praised so much by the internet, by everybody. Everybody loves My Neighbor Totoro. It's the logo for Ghibli is the Totoro. Like, my friend when I was growing up had a gigantic Totoro in his bedroom. Like, we, like, this is the one that I had known about coming into Studio Ghibli. This was the big one. I had seen, you know, obviously I'd heard of some of them, Princess Mononoke, Kiki's Delivery Service, you know, Nausicaä, Grave of the Firefly, Spirited Away. But this was the one that had the most appeal, that I was like, okay, this is going to be like a kid's whatever. I really genuinely dislike this movie. Now, I gave it 2 stars when I watched it on the first go around. I think my expectations were way too high, which is what prevented me from going like 1, 1.5. Mm-hmm. But if I go into it the next viewing and hate it as much as I did the first time, this is a 1-star movie in my estimation. And I know that that's like blasphemous, but it just doesn't do anything for me. I thought it was so boring. I thought it was so pretentious. I thought it was trying so hard. And the Ghibli movies that I have towards the top, Princess Mononoke, The Wind Rises, Spirited Away, Porco Rosso, My Neighbors, the Yamadas, all of those movies have so much of a story and so much heart. And this movie, to me, it tried to have the heart, but because I didn't care about the story at all, I didn't have any heart in it either. Like, it just did nothing for me. It felt dated to me. It was just hugely disappointing. And it was really worrisome because I'm like, oh no, this is supposed to be one of the best ones. It came out in 1988. I was watching these in order for the first time ever. And I was like, I'm in trouble. Like, I'm in trouble. I'm not going to like these movies at all. And then luckily, they were saved by Porco Rosso, which came out just 4 years later. And my fiance actually bought me the steel book edition of it for Christmas because I love it. And I have a picture of it on my wall and everything. Porco Rosso is a great one. And I'll be talking about that very, very shortly, John. But yeah, have you seen Totoro?
I have. It's been a while. I haven't watched it since I was a teenager. But I think that's actually part of the reason why people rave about it so much. I think it does benefit a lot from nostalgia factor. I think a lot of people watched My Neighbor Totoro as a kid, and it's kind of like their introduction to Studio Ghibli and to Japanese animation in general. And I think that really benefits a lot of people from it, because I don't remember it too fondly either. I also thought the story was kind of lacking in it. And while there's like these fantastical elements of it that are cute and whimsical, it does feel lacking to me as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, and I remember when I said that I was disappointed in it, like, people go crazy over that. Like, people love this movie. But I didn't watch it as a kid. And you know what? Like, coming into it for the first time after not watching it as a kid, it doesn't do it for me. And my bottom two, so I only have Earwig and the Witch left. Mm-hmm. I went through all of Ghibli this year. I only have Earwig and the Witch left. I know that one's going to be terrible. I don't even want to watch it. I know it's going to be the worst one. Like, it looks like nonsense. It is nonsense. I get it. Like, I that would be a movie that I would avoid like the plague if it wasn't the last one in this.
Yeah.
But my bottom two are My Neighbor Totoro and Whisper of the Heart. And Jordan Alford, who's an avid listener of us, pretty sure both of those are in like his top 50 movies or something of all time. So I know that I'm kind of a little bit backwards on this, but they just, those like wannabe heartfelt movies that I didn't see as a child hold no nostalgia for me. And they just come across as corny. And My Neighbor Totoro was, see, Whisper of the Heart, I didn't have any expectations for. My Neighbor Totoro, I was like, here we go, baby, Ghibli time. And then I was just like, nope.
I think the theories around My Neighbor Totoro, and like, there were rumors on the internet that it was like based on these like Japanese murders and stuff, were way more interesting than the movie itself actually was.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also pronouncing this totally wrong. It's Ghibli, but whatever. Ghibli. I don't even know. But anyway, let's move on, John, to the next one. Which is, what was your most pleasant surprise from this year?
I hummed and hawed about this one a bit, and I had to give it to the Paddington movies as a pair, because even like less so Paddington 2, because I did get all those rave reviews and is like the highest movie rated on Rotten Tomatoes and things like that, so I knew people really loved that movie. But to me, going into it, it's like, this is a family-oriented movie. There's no way it can be as entertaining as people are saying it is. But watching the first Paddington, you're just so happy when you watch that film. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to deny how good that film makes you feel.
Yeah, so I watched those both for the first time this year too, and I agree. They were both very, very good. I thought it was just going to be overblown because, you know, a lot of times with Rotten Tomatoes, it comes down to who would dislike that movie. Like, you think about a movie like, I don't know, Gladiator. Gladiator has like a 74% or something like that on Rotten Tomatoes because there's going to be people who hate a movie like Gladiator, a 2.5-hour epic about guys killing each other and a brother having a weird relationship with his sister. Like, that's not going to be material for everybody. But I don't think that many would argue that that's a great movie and better than a lot of movies that have a 77% or an 80-something percent or a 90. And a lot of these 100% movies or 99% movies or whatever it is, they're normally like 3-star movies. They're just not dislikable. They're just movies where it's like, obviously I'm like this. But the Paddingtons are so well done. Like, they really are. Like, I think I gave them both 4 stars, or I gave one 4 stars and the other 3.5. Both of them are very, very good movies, not like, but they're also who's going to dislike them. And I think it's the second one. The second one's the one that I gave 4. I gave the first one 3.5. The second one with Brandon Gleason's character is so entertaining. That's how you make a family movie. Like, that's how.
Absolutely. It just appeals to absolutely everyone. You're going to be hard pressed. You could find like the most angry person in the entire world, put on Paddington, and they're going to be smiling throughout it because it's just that wholesome and entertaining.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a big fan of those. And I'm kind of glad you went with 2 movies because I also went with 2 movies for this because I could not pick. One of which I already talked about was Porco Rosso. I thought I was going to hate that movie because here we are. I'm coming through these movies. Grave of the Fireflies had happened, and that was a great one. But pretty much everything else, I'm sitting there going like, what in the world? Like, what is going on? And now I have to watch a movie about a half man, half pig who flies airplanes. This is going to be terrible. That movie is so entertaining. It is so much fun. The art design in that one is phenomenal. The fact that they never explain to you why Porco Rosso is actually a pig is such a brilliant decision. In the book that I got, or in the DVD that I got, in there, there's a thing where they had asked Miyazaki, why is he a pig? And Miyazaki said, that's a ridiculous question. Japanese movies aren't being successful because we get so caught up in explaining unimportant things. Yeah. And it made me laugh because it should be so important. But the way he approaches, like, because he's half pig and half man. That's why. It's such a good movie. It's got like all the daring and the excitement and whatever. That one really blew me away and I was not expecting. The other one that really got me, and as everybody knows at this point, I do my podcast with the Ingmar Bergman Criterion Collection as my stand for my microphone. I loved Smiles of a Summer Night. And I had seen a couple Bergmans. I had seen Persona. I'd seen Wild Strawberries up to this point. I had seen, I'm drawing the blank, The Seventh Seal. Like, I'd seen a lot of his bigger ones up to this point. And the way that the Criterion Collection does it is they present it like it's a like it's a film festival, and they go right down the line of, you know, watch this one first and this one, then this one. And that's why I've watched Wild Strawberries twice. But the first one they have is Smiles of a Summer Night. It is such a great lighthearted comedy just about human interaction, which is so like, I wasn't expecting it at all from what I had known about Bergman. Bergman is always known as the depressing guy. Like, that's just what he is. His movies are black and white. And then once they became color, it might as well have been black and white. Like, he is known for being overly realistic or overly symbolic in a way that just depresses the hell out of his audiences. This movie was so much fun. It is such an entertaining old movie, and the comedy still holds up. Like, it just holds up, and all these relationships, everybody trying to sleep with everybody and who's going to do this. It is such a fun, like, madcap comedy. I couldn't believe how much I loved it. And that and Porco Rosso, I gave both of those 4 stars, which doesn't give them consideration into my top 100. Mm-hmm. But I've also only watched them both once this year. And I do think that as I watch those over time, those are going to kind of grow the way that The Wrestler has grown for me, or Shame has grown for me, or The Hours has grown for me, which they get better every single time I watch them. And I think that both of these movies will do exactly that too. But Smiles of a Summer Night is not like the Bergman you're used to seeing. And I've gone through, probably watched about 7-8 of the movies in this collection here. It really is one of a kind for him. So good, though. So good. Just a fun, fast-paced comedy. that holds up like 50 years, 50 plus years later, 60 years later at this point. So check that one out if you haven't seen it. It's a little bit harder to find, but that's why I use the whole Criterion Collection as a stand. And remember, if you are into Bergman, this baby on 50% discount when the Criterion Collection does their flash sales is $130. And it has movies that are normally $40. Seven Seal is $40. Persona's $40. Scenes for Marriage, $40. Fanny and Alexander, $40. You're getting 40 movies for $130. It's insane. It's one of the most insane deals out there. And they're all, so far, I haven't watched one that I dislike. So, Smiles of a Summer Night, Porco Rosso. John, have you seen either of those?
I haven't, actually. And you can bet they are written down to be watched now.
Damn right they are. Damn right they are. Yeah, Porco Rosso, it's just it's funny how little that one gets discussed. And I almost feel like that's just, it's just a missed Ghibli movie for a lot of kids, you know, and or not the one that they're necessarily going to go back and say, I want to watch The Pig Man again.
Yeah.
All right, John, what did I have? Next, I had, what was the worst movie you watched this year?
Ooh, I have a doozy here. I have a big doozy. There were two movies this year that I gave half a star to. They were this movie called Area 51, which is a found footage movie about these people trying to sneak into Area 51. But the first like hour of it is not entertaining at all. It's not even them at Area 51. It's them prepping for Area 51. And then they get to Area 51 and you're like, okay, this movie has to almost be over. And then there's like another hour left. And you're like, oh my God, this is the longest movie of all time. But it's not the worst movie I watched this year. The worst movie I watched this year was Rubber.
Nice. You hated Rubber. The movie
about a killer tire. It is absolute steaming pile. It tries this meta commentary and it like it thinks it's so smart, but it's like, wow, you are treating the audience like they are the stupidest people in the world, and it's very obvious to tell. And I was really excited for this movie because I had heard good things about it, and you know, it's this movie about a killer tire, and I'm like, oh great, this tire is just gonna be like ramming into people and killing them. No, the tire has psychic powers and like makes things explode and is like in love with the girl. But at the same time, there's like this company that's like selling tickets to watch the tire murder people. It's so bizarre. It's so terrible. It's so bad. I could never watch that movie again.
I love it. Haven't seen either. Rubber's kind of been on my radar because it came out my senior year of high school. And I remember like, you know, everybody talking about it. It was on Netflix, and I just never got around to it. Have no desire to watch Area 51. I remember when that came out, too. That was one of the worst reviewed movies of all time. For me, the worst movie I watched this year was Hillbilly Elegy. That was horrific. Oh, my God. That was very close to being the worst movie I've ever seen in my life, which currently is The Lady in the Water, because The Lady in the Water is just so pretentious and over the top and just pure nonsense. But Hillbilly Elegy, Amy Adams to me is one of the most talented actresses in Hollywood. You would think that she was inept and had never acted in her entire life. Glenn Close got an Oscar nomination for this because her name is Glenn Close and people have heard of her. She is horrible in this movie. The story is terrible. The voiceover, the score, everything is so corny. The dialogue that happens in this movie is terrible. Everything about this movie is garbage. It is a steaming pile of garbage. It is crazy that Ron Howard has fallen so far from where he once was. Not that I was ever a massive fan of Ron Howard. I'd probably say I loved Apollo 13 and Cinderella Man, and everything else was just okay. But man, do you have to think, this was a guy who won Oscars, and now he makes this movie, and I don't even know what to say about it. It's just so bad. It's such an inauthentic take on what's really like, there's no realism to the addictions and the way that this movie handles all of these situations. It does it all with kid gloves. It tries to make it an inspirational movie. I hated every single second of this movie, and I just found myself rolling my eyes the entire time. Benzo says he liked the Hillbilly, or she or he, but they liked Hillbilly LG. That's fine. You can like it, but this was the worst movie that I watched this year, and it really wasn't close.
And because of your take on it, I never even watched it.
Good for you.
While we were prepping for the Oscars, I was like, oh, I have to watch Hillbilly Elegy. I have to see Glenn Close's performance in it to see if like it's worth the nomination and everything. And then you told me how terrible this movie was. And I was like, I'm going to skip that one.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? Watch it one day and tell me if I'm wrong. But I don't think I am. I just could not stand it at all. And it was easily the worst thing I watched this year. All right, John, so far I'm 4 for 4 on getting this in the right order. We're halfway through. Next up, wasn't as good as we remembered. So this is a movie we watched this year with higher expectations than it was able to deliver on. John, what do you have for this one?
This one I took a very long time determining, like, what was the movie that I had previously watched that was different, like, worse than I remembered? Because a lot of the movies I watched this year that I had watched previously, they were very similar to what I had my expectation going into them again. But there were two that I think were way worse than I remember. The first was Scary Movie. Mm-hmm. We talked about that back in October.
We talked about how you were wrong and I was right.
We were talking about all those slasher flicks and everything, but Scary Movie, the first Scary Movie is like held as like this really good satire, but it's so bad because it's just trying to be Scream again. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But the one that really got me, I rewatched Oliver and Company earlier this year, which, you know, is kind of from like those dark ages of Disney during like the mid-80s before Little Mermaid came out. And boy, that movie is so bad.
I haven't seen Oliver and Company in forever because I'm a Billy Joel sort of fan. Yeah. You know, I like Billy Joel as much as the next guy, whatever. But I remember hating that soundtrack when it came out.
There's like two songs in the entire movie.
Yeah, and I just remember like that Walking in Central Park song or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And that one was never one that I would go back to. Even as a kid, I never really went back to that one, and I haven't watched it. We've had Disney Plus, and I've been ripping through a lot of the Disney animated movies. I even suffered through like Home on the Range, Chicken Little, which are both infinitely better, despite the fact that they have half star ratings for me as well. They're both infinitely better than Hillbilly Elegy. I have no desire to watch that movie again.
Yeah, it was just like, I went in. I love when we get like these takes on classic literature. I love like Shakespearean twists and stuff. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But taking a Dickensian story and translating it to kind of like this fun, like New York-y with New York with like cats and dogs and stuff. And I remember really enjoying it as a kid. But I rewatch it, and it's like, A, it doesn't even follow the story of Oliver Twist at all. It's like really loosely Oliver Twist. And Billy Joel's in it for like 5 minutes, and then it's just like, oh, okay, so nothing happens in this movie. Got it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'll check it out one day. Maybe I won't.
It's not really worth it.
Benzo says for him it was Prisoners. That's interesting. Prisoners. Ooh, I remember loving that movie when I watched it the first time. I haven't seen it, though, since it came out, so maybe not. Wasn't I as good as I remember, John? I'm coming right to you, and I'm coming for the jugular, and I'm going with the birds. That movie just does not hit me the way it should have anymore. I don't find it scary. We had a whole podcast about this. Mm-hmm. And I was really thinking about it. Like, that was a movie that is like so revered for Hitchcock and Hollywood and all that. It just doesn't do it for me at all. It just does not do it for me. It's to me, it's like a very bland. The story itself is okay, but I don't really understand the whole bird situation. Just doesn't do it for me. And that's where I got it. I got it here as the most disappointing movie, or the movie that wasn't as good as I remembered it.
It's totally fair. It's definitely slid down my top 100. I don't think it's fallen off my top 100 yet, but it's really one of those movies that I think depends on whether or not you like no answers or you want some answers. And it really does walk that line of, hey, Hitchcock, tell us something, please. And they're like, nah, I'm not going to.
Yep. I hear you, man. I hear you. But that's what I had there. So next, we're going to jump over, and we're almost done here. We're going to go to, what was the movie that was way better than you remembered, or that you enjoyed way more than you thought you were going to on a rewatch?
Oh, easy. Easy. This year, it was Spectre.
Nice. I love that.
We've been talking about Bond a lot, but Spectre, when I first saw it, I hadn't really rewatched Bond in a long time, and it had been a lot of, you know, the Daniel Craig era Bonds at that point. And Spectre came out in a time when everyone was still really praising Skyfall. Mm-hmm. And Skyfall's not as good as everyone says it is. Mm-hmm. But Spectre on a rewatch, when I was rewatching all of the Bond movies back in September, it is so much closer to a Bond movie than any of the other Daniel Craig movies. It's so fun. A lot of people criticize Christoph Waltz's performance as Blofeld, but I think Christoph Waltz is a brilliant Blofeld in this movie. Mm-hmm. I think like the storyline of him being like James Bond's half brother or whatever is ridiculous, but it's so much. It's just the best Bond movie mm-hmm. of the Daniel Craig era. It's not the best movie of the Daniel Craig era, but it's the best Bond movie.
I agree with that. I agree. It is the most authentic 70s, 60s vibe for Bond. Like it goes back to that having fun, going over the top, all that. And it gets knocked for it because I don't know, because that's literally the reason. It's because, but no, I agree. Spectre's a good one there. I have two again for this one. Two movies that could very easily end up in my top 100, which are Nocturnal Animals and The Grand Budapest Hotel. I remember liking The Grand Budapest Hotel when it first came out. I don't remember liking it as much as I did on this rewatch. And I've probably seen that movie now 3 or 4 times. But man, there's so many great layers to that movie. And I probably hadn't seen it in about 5 years. And I'm happy I took a little bit of time in between that and the second or third watch that I had done. It is so fast-paced. It is everything Anderson worked his whole career to get to. The characters are so much fun. The storybook design is so much fun. The production is amazing. Ralph Fiennes is friggin' hilarious the entire time. It just keeps going and going and going. And it was so much more entertaining than I remembered it being. And then the other one with Nocturnal Animals, A Single Man is in my top 100. Tom Ford's made 2 movies, and I think they're both masterpieces. A Single Man is in my top 100. Nocturnal Animals, I remember the first time I watched it, I didn't really buy into the whole story within the story idea. On the second watch, this movie is terrifying. Like, it is just a horrifying depiction of like a failed relationship, of everything that could go wrong. It's such a threatening movie. It's a beautiful movie. Tom Ford just is so distinct in his style, which is probably why he's been successful. You know, that might be the understatement of all time. Maybe. But when you look at how this movie is formatted, and Jake Gyllenhaal and Amy Adams and Armie Hammer and Michael Shannon and Aaron Taylor Johnson, I mean, it just is relentless. And it is such a brutal movie that'll make you terrified to drive on a road in the middle of nowhere. Like, it really will. And, yeah, Michael Shannon, I think this is probably his best performance, maybe probably second best behind Take Shelter, because Take Shelter is ridiculous, but probably second best performance. Gyllenhaal's great. Amy Adams is great. And the story within a story just works for me this time. Also, one of the greatest scores of all time, like of all time. I don't care what anybody says. I sit down and I listen to this score like weekly. It's crazy how often I will listen to this score. It is such a great score. I forget what his last name, I can never pronounce it. It's it starts with a K. That's all I know. But if I try to pronounce it, I'm going to make myself sound like a fool. But yeah, those are the two movies. And I really wanted to pick just one, but I really had a hard time. Korzenowski, I think, something like that. I wanted to pick just one, but they're such different movies, mm-hmm. and they both were so much better than I remember them being. Like, I remember liking both of these movies. That's the key. I didn't dislike either of these. I liked them both, but I didn't like either of them as much as I thought I was going to the first time I watched them. And now I'm like, just launch them. Like, just launch them into the stratosphere. They're both such entertaining and such great movies.
Yeah, and that's why we have to revisit movies. Like, even when we revisit movies that we don't like or that we do like, and we rewatch them again, our opinions change so much based on mm-hmm. where we are at in life. And it's so important. Like, a lot of movies you will see once in your life and that's it. Mm-hmm. But revisiting movies is just such a special experience.
Well, yeah. And you know, the thing is, like, my friend said this a couple weeks ago, and I think I said it on this podcast, but he said, the movie will always be the same, but you won't. Mm-hmm. And that's the key. Like, nothing about Grand Budapest Hotel changed. I have changed. Nothing about Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind has changed, but I have changed. And you grow into these movies, or you grow out of these movies, or something about them just doesn't. And that's why when you get these timeless classics, these you know, these movies that really just withstand. The Graduate comes out in 1967, but still has a very, very now feel to it, even though it's as old as it is. Like, when you get these timeless classics, that's why they're timeless. That's why they're the movies that people always discuss. That's why I think, like, as we move into this superhero Marvel DC world that everybody's just talking about those, oh, that, you know, now they want No Way Home to win Best Picture. And John, I know you have so many things to say about that, but they want No Way Home to win Best Picture. They wanted Black Panther to win Best Picture, whatever it is. These movies aren't as timeless as we think they're going to be. No. And right now I'm actually sitting here. I went to a library and picked up a couple of Best Picture winners. And so, like, I picked up Around the World in 80 Days because I've never seen it. And it's not really high on my list to see, but it was there and it was free, so why not? And that was a movie that at the time was like, oh my God, what a great idea, what a great concept. And now it has aged terribly, at least from what I've heard. I haven't actually watched it yet. Yeah. But The Greatest Show on Earth, you know, a Cecil B. DeMille circus movie, which is honestly still pretty good. But it's aged really, really poorly. And then, you know, you have a movie like Casablanca, which could still be made today and everybody still loves it and it doesn't age. I think that's where a lot of Oscar winners, I will say that after watching, I have 14 Oscar Best Picture winners left. Mm-hmm. And I really do believe that a lot of the time when it comes to Oscar winners, the Oscars will often pick the wrong movie. Almost every year they pick the wrong movie, but very rarely do they pick a bad movie. And I think that that is a key. They will pick a movie where you say that's a 2.5-star movie, but that doesn't mean it's a bad movie. It just shouldn't have won Best Picture. That very rarely do they pick a bad movie. And, you know, I just think that there's something interesting to look at as we get into, like, you know, movies nowadays where, oh, this is going to be great, this whatever. And then people do a lot of times rewatch, you know, some movie that they saw the first time in theaters and loved it, and it doesn't hold up for them as much. I still have not watched The Force Awakens since I saw it in theaters. And I'm very happy about that.
Probably for the best.
I loved that movie in theaters. I saw it at the Chinese theater, amazing thing. And then I went back to New Jersey and I watched it with my dad in the theaters and we both enjoyed it. And like, that was it. I have not watched it since then though, because it's probably not going to be as good. And that's okay. Eventually I will. But movies, your opinion on things will change based on the mood you're in, based on the hype that's around something. And I have to watch The Last Jedi and gouge my eyes out as soon as the new year starts. I'm starting the new year with a terrible bang.
Strong. It's going to be great because I'm going to talk about that movie for a very long time next week.
Oh, but you know I can't wait. You know I can't wait. Benzo said here, what was your guys' favorite Netflix original movie of the year? John, I don't think I watched any of the Netflix original movies. Is Power of the Dog the top one? Did you watch it?
I did, and it is in my top five of 2021.
Okay, cool. Yeah, see, I don't have any I don't really watch the Netflix original movies because a lot of times they're just long.
Yeah.
All right, let's get into these bigger ones now. What are your top five movies of 2021? So not your top five. These are the top five movies that actually came out in this calendar year. Just start with number five, John, and we'll just kind of go back and forth on this.
So number five, I kind of go back and forth. I have my honorable mention was In the Heights. It brought me back to theaters after like COVID shut everything down again this year. And it's a fun movie. I just rewatched it actually last week and it still held up. I was very impressed with it, but my number five has to go to Evangelion 3.1 plus 1.0, Thrice Upon a Time.
Thanks for that with the numbers.
Movie. It's the title of the movie. It's not my fault. I know, I'm messing with you. But this movie absolutely astonished me. Watching it when it first came out, I had rewatched Evangelion leading up to it. I'd rewatched the Rebuild series and remembered how fantastic those movies had been. We had been waiting for this final movie to come out for so long. And I was like, okay, the third movie was kind of the worst one of the three that have been released so far. How is this going to be? And whew, it's incredible. I have the end of Evangelion way up in my top 100. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of up there as a like holder for like the entire series as a whole. Mm-hmm. And this movie may be better than it.
Wow. And there goes John saying bold statements right off the bat. My number five, I'm kind of doing a cheat here, and I go Judas and the Black Messiah. It came out in 2021, which bothers me a lot because it shouldn't be in my top five of this year since it's already past Oscar time and all of that. But because the Oscars and release dates and everything were thrown off because of COVID, Judas and the Black Messiah is technically a 2021 movie. We talked so much about this with Daniel Kaluuya's Oscar-winning performance, as we all know, where he then went up there and was very thankful his mom and dad had sex. We had all of that fun stuff happen already. This is a great movie. One of the best movies on this type of topic in a long time. Mm-hmm. I'd say Black Klansman is up there as well. But, you know, this was just a very, very entertaining, very stylized movie that really, really worked and had some great performances straight down the line. And it comes in at my number five. Like I said, I haven't seen a lot from 2021 yet. I like to wait for the Oscar nominations to actually come out and then just start watching a bunch of stuff. And this way I'm kind of in that mindset of like, should this win? What's going on? So yeah, I go Judas and the Black Messiah at number five here.
Yeah. I mean, that movie was absolutely phenomenal. It was one of the first Best Picture movies I watched for last year's Oscar season. Mm-hmm. And it was really incredible. The performances by Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield are incredible. Yeah, Jesse Plemons in that movie.
Yeah.
And Jesse Plemons is perhaps one of the most underrated actors out there right now. We'll talk about him in a little bit, but it's an outstanding cast and an outstanding picture.
Yeah. What do you got at four?
I have The French Dispatch, which I know you have
right now.
Yeah. I know you have it a little lower, but I loved the structure of The French Dispatch. I loved how it felt. I loved it. It feels so Wes Anderson. I love that Wes Anderson was really kind of challenging himself by having this movie in black and white for the majority of it. It really impacted how much Wes Anderson isn't just about like the storybook elements with like the pastel colors and everything, but it's his writing and it's the acting he gets from his phenomenal cast that really drives his films.
Yeah, I mean, the acting is great. It's always great in all of his movies. Like I said, it was more of the pacing of the first half of that movie, and then I thought it really picked up. The Jeffrey Wright part I thought was the best part. It just doesn't have that same like click. Like once I rewatched Grand Budapest after watching that, I was like, that's what I was looking for. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Moonrise has that, Royal Tenenbaums has that, Darjeeling Limited has that, Grand Budapest has that. This movie doesn't have that for me. But I'm also not a big Life Aquatic fan and stuff like that. And I know that, you know, there's like...
enjoy that movie a lot.
Yeah, even though Wes Anderson is a polarizing figure in himself, there's also a polarization within his own fan base. And I'm definitely on the more normal side of it, I think, where like I'm less of a Wes Anderson fanboy and more of a... I like his movies that are actually pretty well received rather than like Life Aquatic, which is like his diehard's favorite movies.
Yeah. But I really love, like you said, like the pacing was really off in the first bit. I love that first segment. That first segment was so, with Benicio del Toro and Madeline.
Lea Seydoux.
Lea Seydoux. Yeah. Madeline's definitely her James Bond character. Wow.
Yeah, definitely. 100%.
Totally out of there. But the Lea Seydoux's phenomenal in this movie. Benicio del Toro is also incredible. And then. The Tilda Swinton's strange, like eccentric art character. It's just so much fun. And I love that segment. I felt like the second segment was the one that was a little bit like off for me, despite the fact that like Timothy Chalamet is absolutely incredible in it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I definitely get the pacing concerns with the film.
Yep. So I go to my number four, and it's another one that had a little bit of weird pacing for me and left me going, uh-oh, for the first 45 minutes. And then it really picks up, and I can't wait to see what's going to come next. But I have Dune. Beautiful movie. Just an incredibly well-directed movie. The cinematography in this movie is stellar. If the next two movies stink, this movie will drop down significantly for me, though, because it is so little of a standalone movie. I always go back to, if The Fellowship of the Ring was the only good Lord of the Rings movie, it's still a great movie because it still has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Dune doesn't have an end. Dune really is kind of just an all beginning, which is fine. They knew they were going to get their sequel and their, you know, their trilogy. But I really liked this movie a lot. I was a little concerned about what was going to happen at the beginning because they were speaking in ways that I didn't understand. But we'll see what ends up happening as this moves forward. I'm very excited to see what comes next. If the next two are great, this could move up and become even better because it's so much more of a complete story. But right now, I put it here at number four.
Yeah, I love Dune. I think it's sitting at about number seven for me on the year right now. It was a phenomenal movie. It was breathtaking. Yeah, it's a long movie, but it didn't feel that long for me. I know a few people who did have a problem with how slow and meticulous Villeneuve approaches the film and the lore behind everything that happens in Dune.
Yes. So what do you have at number three then? I thought Doom would be in your top five, so I'm kind of surprised. What do you have?
I did too. Then I remembered some of these other movies that came out this year. Nice. At number three, I do have The Power of the Dog.
Okay.
Now, I kind of talked about this when I first watched it, but it was a movie that really surprised me because a lot of people, I watched it right as people were really starting to talk about it and they're starting to talk about, you know, how it's like the front runner for the Oscars this year and stuff like that. I'm like, okay, it's a Netflix movie. How good could it be? And more so, it's a Western starring Benedict Cumberbatch. Mm-hmm. And I was really concerned, but watching this movie, the performances from Jesse Plemons and Kirsten Dunst and Cody Schmidt McPhee. Are all incredible. Even Benedict Cumberbatch's performance is very good. As like we do see good performances from Benedict Cumberbatch. He's a terrible American accent though. Mm-hmm. And overall, it was a very well done movie. It kept me engaged. It builds its characters in a way where you think you know what's going to happen, and then it just kind of like slowly dissipates and gives you a really satisfying conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I need to check that out. The other one, I haven't seen that, and I haven't seen Belfast, which makes me almost feel like a fraud doing this podcast.
I haven't seen Belfast either, and I've heard really good things about it recently.
Yeah, Belfast, when it came out so quietly and was so under-discussed that I didn't really go out of my way to see it, and now I kind of regret not going out of my way to see it. So I have to see those two. Otherwise, I've seen pretty much everything big so far this year, so I'm not too overly concerned. But yeah, definitely got to see Power of the Dog and very excited to sit down and watch it. Wanted to watch it before today, but I didn't because instead, like I said, I half drunk watched The Spy Who Loved Me last night instead. So, you know, whatever. My number three, I have Nobody. What I found to be one of the most entertaining movies of this year. It is exactly what it was advertised as, and it never for 1 second starts to take itself seriously. And I appreciated that so much. Bob Odenkirk, why am I drawing a blank on the old guy's name? This is embarrassing. What's the old guy's name from Christopher Lloyd? Thank you. Bob Odenkirk, Christopher Lloyd, they're so good. And this movie never gets dark pointlessly. It never, and every time you think it's going to go there, it subverts your expectations. Incredibly fast paced, just keeps going from start to finish, doesn't let up. I love watching Odenkirk. Like, I thought the biggest problem with this was going to be that he wasn't going to be believable in the role. But because of the way that it's presented, it is so believable that it just works. It just works for the whole time. And it does have the best Letterboxd review, which the top Letterboxd review is, in the middle of this movie, my dad leaned over and whispered, "This is my Black Panther." That really is like the funniest Letterboxd review of all time. It means that he literally is watching this movie where a dad who's living a miserable suburban existence is just beating the shit out of people. And he just is like, this is the defining movie for me, as the dad who's just stuck here. Odenkirk is so good in this movie. It is incredibly entertaining. And if you haven't seen it yet, definitely check it out. Would have been the biggest surprise of the year for me had Nocturnal Animals and The Grand Budapest Hotel not been so much better than I remembered.
Yeah, I haven't actually watched it yet. I've heard good things about it, but I'll have to give it a watch.
Yeah, definitely do. What's your number two?
Licorice Pizza.
Yeah, there you go. That's gonna be on my list soon.
Yeah. New Paul Thomas Anderson. Very different Paul Thomas Anderson movie. I went, I saw it by myself. It was phenomenal. It was everything I was anticipating. Cooper Hoffman. Mm-hmm. Absolutely brilliant performance from him in his debut here. And a lot of
there's moments in this movie where you think you're looking at Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah. Like he's definitely his father's son. And
yeah.
PTA understood that and knew how to foster his abilities in this movie. And it's a weird coming of age movie, but I love the take of it where it's this coming of age movie, not for Gary, the 15-year-old, but rather for Alana, the 25-year-old. Because that's just a coming of age story that we never get. We don't get that mid-20s person who's completely lost all that often.
And when we do, they're always dating somebody their own age, and that's how they get out of it.
Exactly. And it's just so fascinating, and it just feels so much more relatable as a coming of age story.
Mm-hmm. I very much agree with you. Elena Hame in this movie is fantastic. It's
so good.
Very entertaining. I like that neither her nor Cooper Hoffman are supposed to be good looking in this movie because it just adds to the realism of everything that's going on. This is my number one for the year. So I'll just talk about it now since it's the first duplicate we have. I went and saw it in theaters yesterday, actually. I went to a 10 a.m. showing, and I was the only one in the theater, which was a phenomenal experience. It's exactly how I wanted to watch this movie. I got to sit down, watch it alone, which when you go see a movie in South Florida, normally you're going to have somebody answering their phone or talking through the movie because they're horrible, horrible moviegoers. But this, like, I got to just sit there, center seat, all by myself. And I loved every second of this movie. And I think the weirdest part for me was that I actually walked out of this movie with a smile on my face. And I didn't have a smile on my face. The man had just been bludgeoned with a bowling pin, and I couldn't believe that I had seen that. And I was smiling. I actually walked out of this movie with a smile on my face because it left me with a smile on my face. I felt good after watching this movie. I felt good while watching this movie. I thought Cooper Hoffman's character was so interesting. This 15-year-old who's already had success and is trying to build off of it. I was very happy to see Skylar Gazando get a role. Skylar Gazando is one of the most talented young actors out there, but he doesn't take the right roles. He's so good at acting. People need to keep putting him in movies because he played an 18-year-old, 19-year-old, and he seemed like he was playing somebody so much better than that. When I worked at the international sales company, I actually did sales on one of his movies. And unfortunately, it wasn't, you know, it was kind of like whatever movie it was. But he is such a talented actor. And I was so happy to see him even in the small role that he was in. They did a great job in this movie of only bringing in the big actors for small parts. The decision to have Tom Waits and Sean Penn be in literally 5 minutes of this movie. The decision to have Bradley Cooper be in maybe 10 minutes of this movie. These were brilliant decisions because anything more than that is too much. But it allowed Elena Hame and Cooper Hoffman to continue to have the movie be their own and just have these other people kind of be who they intersect with. I love that Sean Penn is blatantly playing William Holden, even though I think by this point, no, William Holden was still alive. William Holden was coming out in Network 5 years later, where he pretty much plays the character Sean Penn is playing in this, but his name is Jack Holden. I love all of it. I thought it was a great movie. It wasn't as great as I was expecting. It's not the best Paul Thomas Anderson movie. But I'd probably put it like this is right there with Phantom Thread is like his fourth, fifth best movie in my estimation, where I go Boogie Nights, Magnolia, There Will Be Blood. And then, you know, it's right behind that, which is still a pretty damn good spot to be because you were Paul Thomas Anderson.
It's a movie that you knew going in. It's not a question of whether or not you're going to like the movie. It's a question of how much you're going to like the movie. And it was really refreshing to see this from Paul Thomas Anderson and to kind of see this different take on the San Fernando Valley that we don't usually get from him.
Yeah. And it was a more positive, but it still had its negativity. It still had its, you know, its hate. And I love the whole thing with Encino and Sherman Oaks. Cause I lived in Sherman Oaks and one of my best friends lived in Encino and he might as well have lived in New Jersey because nobody ever went to Encino to see him. It was so far away. So like all those little winks and everything like that throughout the movie. But the fact that Cooper Hoffman never gets angry in this movie, you know, like he just keeps on keeping on the whole time. And every time it seems like, you know, he gets mad at one point, but it's like every time it seems like there's going to be this big blow up, it really isn't. And it's just captivating. It's a very interesting hangout movie. Between this and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, we've gotten two great Hollywood hangout movies from two great directors in the last couple of years. And, you know, hopefully Wes Anderson does one next and we can just have everybody making Hollywood hangout movies.
There you go. So, Phil, what was your number two of the year then?
So my number two was No Time to Die, the James Bond movie. Would have been number one if Licorice Pizza didn't exist. But No Time to Die, I thought was a fascinating movie. I thought every decision they made, I thought the pacing was great. I loved the 007 storyline where he's no longer there, so they have a new 007 and all that. I really, really, really thought this movie was unbelievably interesting. Very entertaining. I love that it went there. Rami Malek still isn't as good of an actor as everybody says he is. But I was still into this movie from start to finish. One of the best Bonds, easily. So yeah, that was my number two. And then Licorice Pizza was my number one. But John, what do you got at number one?
West Side Story.
Wow.
I can't believe I am saying, I cannot believe I am saying a Steven Spielberg movie is my number one movie of the year. But the amount of emotion that movie put me through when I watched it last week, it was just, it was undeniable. It was, I was smiling the entire time if I wasn't bawling my eyes out. And even then I was probably smiling too. And yes, a lot of that has to do with the story and a lot of that has to do with the music, but it was phenomenally put together and Steven Spielberg just far surpassed my expectations with it.
Yeah, I that's another one. I actually thought that I said that I had seen all the big ones. I haven't seen that one either, but that one I wasn't considering a big one. I'm still not convinced, John. I'm still not convinced. I got to go check it out, but I can't believe you just put that at number one. That's really surprising.
I can't either. I can't either. I was like, oh, it's Licorice Pizza, and I just thought about it, and I thought about the emotions that West Side Story got out of me. Put it just that little bit above Licorice Pizza.
There you go. All right, well, there you have it. So I'll just rattle my five off again one more time for anybody who wants to hear. Judas and the Black Messiah, Dune, Nobody, No Time to Die, Licorice Pizza. As I said, haven't seen much from 2021 yet, though.
And then mine were Evangelion 3.0 plus 1.0, Thrice Upon a Time, The French Dispatch, The Power of the Dog, Licorice Pizza, and West Side Story.
There you go. All right. Now we get into the biggest moment of the night. Best five first watches of the year. Both of us have seen over 365. Well, I've seen 363 unique movies, even though I know the Muppets should be counting. But either way, we've both seen over 365 movies this year. That will not be happening again next year. You guys are going to be lucky if I had 100 movies next year. I don't think I could do this again. It was time consuming, but it was rewarding. It was fun. And I'm glad to have said I've done it because not many people can say they've watched a movie a day for their entire, for an entire year. But the best five movies we watched for the first time this year, John, I'm actually going to kick this one off because the movie we've talked about already, I have Queen Margo as my number five, a movie we actually did a whole podcast dedicated to. It's a 1994 movie about the whole, you know, religious wars that were going on in France during, I guess it was the 1500s, 1600s. I haven't seen it now since January, but
yeah.
What an entertaining movie. What a brutally, graphically violent movie. It never lets up. It's like Game of Thrones, but in 2 hours and 40 minutes. And I'm talking like season one and two Game of Thrones, where it's just people betraying each other and stabbing each other and moving on. What a great movie. Just a massive epic that holds up so much, so many characters. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't make it easy for you to follow, but it shouldn't. It's a rewarding movie. And a man sweats blood and dies in his bed for a very long time. And it's number five on my top watches and probably going to end up in my top 100 when all is said and done.
Queen Margo is just such a fantastic period piece. It's so different because it really is like this period piece of the 16th century France and just this woman empowerment at the same time. And it's so unique in the way it's presenting stuff, especially in like 1994. And it was a phenomenal watch.
Yeah. What's your number five?
My number five is The Wages of Fear.
Oh, yeah. I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah. I highly recommend this movie. This is one of the most tense movies I've ever seen. It starts off a little slow, but as you build into it, it's about these men who are stuck in South America, and they're just trying to find money so they can get out of South America at that point. So they take a job of transporting a wad of dynamite across this incredibly dangerous route. And as soon as that key starts and they start going along for the drive, which is a good like hour of the movie. It is you edge of your seat tension. You are just like, oh my God, are these guys going to make it? Are they going to explode? What's going to happen? And it's absolutely phenomenal. It's a movie that I went in, I had heard good things about it from that side of it, but I did not expect it to be as good as it was.
That's awesome. Yeah, I really want to watch that movie. Need to see that one badly. It's been on my list for a while now, and I just haven't gotten around to it. It always seems like it's too long or whatever, but that's definitely one that I want to check out before all is said and done here. My number four, John, I'm going to keep going ahead of you here just because it's another one that we talked about and did an entire podcast dedicated to. But I go with Jean-Pierre Jeunet's Delicatessen here at number four. One of the weirdest movies you will ever see in your entire life. It's an apocalyptic movie about a bunch of people who live above a deli where the guy butchers humans and feeds them the food because that's all there is. Such a weird movie. Dominic Pignon is so funny in this movie. It's just so stylized. It's so freaking French. And I can't wait. Jeunet actually just announced a new movie coming out soon. And I can't wait to see it already because he is such a talented director. And it's been, I think, 6 or 7 years since he's made one. The Tale of T.S. Spivet or something like that, which I actually haven't seen. But I love Delicatessen. I know we did a whole podcast about it, so I won't spend too much time talking about it here. But it's my number four, and it's definitely going to be in my top 100 on a new list coming out. Just a freaking entertaining movie. And it's just... it's one of those where you sit there and you just say how and why and all of those fun things, but it just doesn't stop. And Guillermo del Toro stole everything he knows from this movie. That's all I'll say, because the flooding of the bathroom scene is straight out of The Shape of Water, which this came out 20 years before that.
No, it was such a fun, wild ride to watch Delicatessen this year. I wasn't really 100% sure what to expect going in. It certainly wasn't the movie that we watched, but... oh, it was so much fun.
Yeah, it's a weird one. It's weird. Yeah. That's all. It's weird. All right, John, what do you have it for?
At number four, I have Tokyo Story. So finally got around to watching some Ozu this year, and it's as good as people make it out to be. This movie is absolutely incredible. It's slow, so I get why people wouldn't like it, but the heartbreaking journey of this film... of these two parents who just feel so distant from their children, and they go visit them to only feel even more distant once they're there. It's beautiful. It's some of the best filmmaking I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's a movie that's been on my list, and what's prevented me from watching it is that I really have to be in the right mindset for it, and I really want to give it the time it deserves. I don't want this to be a movie that I'm pausing or checking my phone or whatever. Like, I want this to be a movie where I sit down and for 2.5 hours, I just watch a movie. And that's what's prevented me from watching it so far this year. I don't want it to be one of those movies where halfway through I'm getting tired and I'm going and I'm going to be like, hey, I'm going to go to sleep. Like I did with The Spy Who Loved Me last night because I've seen it 150 times. And that's what's preventing me. But that is definitely a top of the list movie going into 2022. And I very much look forward to watching it.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. If anyone really enjoys slow cinema, and enjoys these very personal stories, it's absolutely beautiful.
All right, man. Well, I am making my last Ghibli reference of the day here with number three. And I have Princess Mononoke. I thought this movie was masterful. This movie was so freaking good. This is everything that animation is supposed to be. It has the heart. It has the beauty. It has the story. It is an epic that just happens to be drawn. And that's what makes it even more impressive is that this movie was hand-drawn. That gives me chills to think about. Somebody had to draw this movie. Somebody had to, like, how did they do that? The animation is incredible. It is far and away the best Studio Ghibli movie. I really don't even think it's close. One of the best animated movies of all time. And it just captures, like, I'm a big Final Fantasy fan. Mm-hmm. I love the Square Enix, like their style, Final Fantasy 12, Final Fantasy 10, Final Fantasy 14. Like, those are the types of games that I love. I never played the PS1 ones or the whatever it was for the first 10, but I never played those. But I love those stories. I love these worlds, these adventures, these weird things that you're killing off and characters and whatever. Princess Mononoke is a video game that just happens to be a movie that has all of the heart and all of the adventure and all of the excitement packed into 2 hours. It is a brilliant movie. It is just a brilliant movie. And I really, really, really loved every second of it. Couldn't recommend it any more highly. As somebody who, you know, was hit or miss on a lot of these Ghibli movies, this was the one that blew me away. It lived up to the expectations and surpassed the expectations. And it's number 3 on my list of top 5 watches this year.
It's been a good decade since I've watched Princess Mononoke. I think I definitely have to go revisit it again. But I do remember it's just captures a different sense than a lot of these Ghibli movies do, where a lot of the Ghibli movies are a lot more like family oriented and everything. Whereas this is a very big, like, environmentalist aspect to the film. Mm-hmm. And it hits in a different way than a lot of Ghibli movies do.
Yeah, it's absolutely not a family movie. Yeah. I think that's what's so, you know, that also is what's so good about it. And, you know, her drinking the blood out of the wolf is, you know, it's great.
Iconic. It's great.
Yeah, it is. It really is. It's freaking awesome. So what do you have at 3, John?
At 3, I have Fritz Lang's as M. This is a movie about time, John. This movie blew me away. Peter Lorre is absolutely spectacular in this film. And it's just this haunting. It's so scary because, like, we have this, like, child murderer in this film, and that's not the scariest part of this movie. Mm-hmm. Because the scariest part of the movie is definitely the mob mentality that this town takes over trying to find this person. It's haunting. It's beautiful. Every performance in it is absolutely spectacular, and it's a movie that everyone should watch.
Yeah, it's such a great movie. The use of what is it, John? You always know it.
In the Hall of the Mountain King.
In the use of that song throughout this movie, and the balloon, and all of, I mean, it is just a brilliant, brilliant movie. One I haven't seen in quite some time, and I need to rewatch. But what a freaking movie! And it's so, Fritz Lang and Peter Lorre, like, two of the more underappreciated people from classic cinema. Because Fritz Lang, it took him a little bit to make the transition. A lot of his movies are silent, so that doesn't help either. Anything about Metropolis, obviously a very revered movie, but one that not many people are going to go back and rewatch because it's 1927 and it's completely silent. That's a hard ask for a lot of people, especially when the movie is 2.5 hours long. But Peter Lorre, everybody has seen Peter Lorre, and most people just don't realize that they're watching Peter Lorre. Casablanca, The Maltese Falcon, Arsenic and Old Lace, The Man Who Knew Too Much. He's in everything, and he's good in everything. He's never the lead man, except for really in M. But he is just his eyes, his expressions, the way he delivers lines. Peter Lorre is one of the all-time greats, and just unfortunately never quite made it to that next level where he's a household name the way somebody like a Bogart or something like that is, who he was in the same era and a lot of the same movies. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah, it's a film on its own level for, like, that time period. 1931, and having a movie this good come out, it's incredible.
Well, and what's crazy is I actually think two of the most underappreciated movies of all time came out the same year, that year. It was M, and it was City Lights, the Chaplin movie. Mm-hmm. And City Lights is, in my opinion, the best Chaplin movie. And it was another one that was just very – it doesn't stand up as well because, again, it is a silent movie.
Yeah.
But, wow, is it a phenomenal love story that is just – it holds true almost 100 years later. And then you had Frankenstein and Dracula both came out the same year too. 1931, not a bad year.
Good year. So what are they? Good year for cinema. Yeah.
Gave Best Picture to Samarin or whatever it is, considered the worst Best Picture of all time. And I still haven't watched it, so I can't say anything on that one yet. All right, number 2 for me, I have The Father. Another movie that technically, or well, another movie that was a 2020 movie that I watched this year. It devastated me. Anthony Hopkins' performance in this movie, I think, could be argued it's the best performance in the history of film. Like, it male, female, it doesn't matter. It could be argued that the end of this movie, spoilers, when he starts sobbing, asking for his mother, Oh my God. Like, it is such a devastating movie. I love the style of this movie. I love the fact that it just keeps spinning you in a circle and makes you really feel like you're in it with him, but makes it seem like there is a conspiracy against him. Something is going on and it's not your fault. The way Florian Zeller is actually able to capture this and make it seem as though you're him and put you in the shoes of Anthony Hopkins is just an incredible feat of filmmaking. It just keeps spinning in a circle when all of a sudden you're back at the table at that one point after like the whole, it's breathtaking. It's brilliant. The acting is phenomenal. Olivia Colman is great, but Anthony Hopkins' performance, this is his best. And I'm saying that over Hannibal Lecter. This is the greatest performance of his career. And I would argue it could be the greatest performance of anyone's career. One of the all-time greats. And this is a movie that probably comes in my top 50 or so in when I finally do get to put together a new top 100. This movie just blew me away.
We talked about it when we were going over the Oscars or the Oscar nominations and everything. But we went into that podcast saying it's really unfortunate that Anthony Hopkins isn't going to win best actor for this movie because of everyone's going to be like, Chadwick Boseman should get it because he's dead or because he died. And his performance was very good in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. But the shock of finishing the Oscars with Joaquin Phoenix going up there and saying, the award for best actor goes to Anthony Hopkins, who is in here. Bye. And it was so deserved because Anthony Hopkins is absolutely brilliant in this movie. Olivia Colman, also fantastic. Rufus Sewell, everyone in this movie is so good. The way that this film captures this sense of dementia and just like that idea of like not really knowing what's going on, the subtle changes in the room to demonstrate like different time periods and everything. It's a brilliant film.
It really is. It really is. And it's number two for the movies that I watched this year out of all of them. Out of everything, all 365, this is the second best one that I watched this year. John, what's your second best?
Sutton Tongo.
Nice, John.
I'm going for it.
See how much 7.5 hours.
7.5 hour long movie by Bellatar, 1994. Oh my God, this movie absolutely blew me away. I have never sat down and watched a 7.5 hour movie before. Never expected for it to feel like a 2-hour movie. This movie, Bellatar's direction, absolutely genius. Starting this movie, you start this movie with about 10 minutes of cows leaving a barn and mounting each other. And it just sets the pace for the entire film. That when you get everything that happens throughout the 7.5 hours, it just doesn't feel like it's been that long while you're watching it. To be able to do that in such a masterful and artistic way, to be able to tell the story of this failing collective farm at the fall of communism, as every person in the town is trying to figure out how they can make away with the money. And then they find out that someone they thought was dead isn't dead, comes back and is trying to convince them to start another collective farm instead at a different place. It's so brilliant. There's one of the most heartbreaking scenes I've ever seen. I mean, there's also like 10 minutes of a girl beating up a cat. And that was one of the most disturbing scenes I've ever seen. But it's so powerful at the same time. And then you get the actual like Satan's Tango scene, which is 15 minutes of people dancing in a bar. And it's 15 minutes of this guy balancing a loaf of bread on his face. And it's so entertaining. It tells you so much about all these characters. You're just connecting to all of them. And you would think a 7.5 hour long movie would have all these wide characters and like a large ensemble cast, but really you're only at about like 12 people and you just get to know them so intimately in this film. It's masterful. It's honestly one of the best films I've ever seen.
Well, I will check it out one day when I have 7.5 hours to spare, John, as I'm sure so many people will. Almost need to break it up like it's a mini series.
It's okay. It's broken into different segments, so you can almost do it.
You can almost do it. There you go.
You can almost do it, yeah.
All right, my number one, top one, it's not going to surprise anybody since I've talked about it twice already on this podcast, but I have Wild Strawberries by Ingmar Bergman. I've already talked about it twice because it was the best movie of the week I watched twice this year. It's just such a devastating look at aging and growing old and realizing that things have passed you by and being just a disgruntled older person who wishes that they would have done things differently and now being surrounded by youth and being rewarded for doing all these things that you're not even proud of anymore and feeling like you're a fraud and a phony and wishing that you could still be your younger self. And the most brilliant thing that Ingmar Bergman does in this movie is we see numerous times the main character's family as younger people. You know, we see his cousin and his mother and his father and his brothers and sisters and whatever. We never see the main character as a younger person. He inserts himself into these scenes where he is watching himself. The older self is watching the younger interactions of everybody, but he is never there and he's always missing and he's always distant. It is such a brilliant technique and it's so heartbreaking. It's just one of the most devastating movies. And you know, it's just about, it's about something that we all go through, which is growing old, or at least if we're lucky enough, to just grow old and wonder, what did I do wrong? What did I do right? What do I wish I could do differently? What do my relationships amount to at this point? And yeah, it's such a simple concept. Rather than flying, he decides to drive. That's it. And when you can make a movie about rather than flying, he decides to drive and make it as powerful as Wild Strawberries, you have one of the greatest movies ever made in the history of film. So yeah, this is an up there one for me for an all time great.
I mean, I don't have the Ingmar Bergman collection as my mic stand right now, or in my apartment at all. So it's Wild Strawberries is one that's on my list. I haven't gotten around to it yet, but I definitely have to. I definitely need to dive more into Bergman, but from what I have seen of Bergman, his comprehension of these questions of like growing old and death and all of those like philosophical questions that he poses in his films, he understands what he's doing. And I'm really looking forward to seeing Wild Strawberries when I do get around to it.
Yeah. I think you'll like it. I really do think that you'll like it. That's all I'll say. I don't want to, you know, it's just one of those movies, man. Mm-hmm. You hear all about it all the time. People always talk about it. It always gets great reviews, always up there in the best cinema ever. And it really holds it up. It really does. What's your top movie, John?
Well, I'm going to continue our trend of not having a single American movie in either of our top fives. I have Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai.
Holy shit. I never realized that we didn't have a single American movie in our top. Because I guess the father isn't American, right?
Because it's a British and French movie, yeah.
Wow, so we don't have... I didn't even do that on purpose. I didn't even realize
that. Neither did I. Neither did I, but neither of us have an American movie in our top five.
That is insane. That's crazy. Like, okay, but anyway, Seven Samurai, I still haven't seen. I'm embarrassed to say it, but go ahead.
It's okay. We have to watch it for the podcast eventually because I have it in placement of Fellowship of the Ring because you have that movie higher than I do. Mm-hmm. But Akira Kurosawa is able to take the samurai genre and just make such incredible films out of it. The journeys he makes of all of these characters. Yes, it's a 4-hour movie. Yes, it's long. It's okay. It's not as long as Son and Tango, I promise, guys. But he just creates these characters that are so well-defined in all of his films. And Seven Samurai does it in a way that I had never seen before. And the fact that it took me this long to watch this movie is kind of embarrassing. But at the same time, it's 1954 was such a big year for Japanese cinema when it comes to the West because we do have Seven Samurai and the first Godzilla movie. But Akira Kurosawa definitely shows why he's so massive. This is a movie that's probably finding its way into my top 10 moving forward.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised. I mean, I feel like it's a movie that I will very much enjoy. Kurosawa still has not made a 4-star movie in my estimation because I've only seen a couple and I just haven't given any 4 stars. That's really not his fault. But I definitely, that's another one. Like the reason I haven't watched it is because I want to give it the proper watching. You know what I mean? Like that's not a movie that you just sit down and you just say, hey, it's on. And now, oh, we got to pause it. Got to go get something from outside. Got to go eat dinner. Like what? I want to really watch it. And
yeah.
It's long, so to find that amount of time is a difficult task. Yep. but I will definitely check that one out soon. And that's a great list right there. I mean, I think both of those top fives there, those are movies that it's a good mix of movies that people have probably heard of and very mm-hmm. much have seen and enjoy. And then also movies that maybe people haven't really given the time to, but I'll rip through mine again one more time. It was Queen Margot, Delicatessen, Princess Mononoke, The Father, and Wild Strawberries. And John, you had?
The Wages of Fear, Tokyo Story, M, Satantango, and Seven Samurai.
There you go. Not a single American movie in there, as John pointed out, which is crazy. But yeah, just great. Like, it was a great year for watching movies. I finally got around to a lot of movies that I always meant to watch and just never really got around to. This podcast kind of forced me to do that. Wanting to watch 365 movies in 365 days also got me to do that. It was a great year. It will never happen again. Like I said, I'm lucky if I get to 100 again. But having Letterboxd has really made this easier to just kind of put into order. What's the best things that I've watched this year? What's the top movie that I watched this year? Where am I at, like, in terms of what I've seen and what I haven't seen? What is proving to be more forgettable than I would have thought? What's more memorable than I would have thought? And made making this list take me about 3 minutes as opposed to, like, the 5 weeks that it took me to make my top 100 going into 2021. So this was a lot of fun, though, for everybody who's been listening to this podcast since we started it in January. I appreciate it. I know we both do. It's been a hell of a journey. I wasn't really expecting anybody to listen. I think this is going to end up being our most watched episode just based on how many people were watching it live, which really surprises me. Well done to all of you. I hope you enjoyed it. We will be going through all of 2021 as well, with a couple weeks off in there, because I have to do this thing called getting married. So that will take away. John, unfortunately, I won't be podcasting with you from my honeymoon.
That's okay.
Believe it or not. But this has been a lot of fun. It's been very, very enjoyable. And I hope you've all enjoyed it as much as we have, because watching great movies is always a good time. And finally getting around to it. Like, I'm finally down to one Ghibli movie left. I have 14 Best Picture winners left. I think I only have like 7 movies since 1990 that were nominated for Best Picture that I haven't seen. Like, that's crazy to think about. And a lot of that comes from just sitting down and watching movies this year and being like, hey, it's part of the New Year's goals. So let's make it happen. But it's been a hell of a journey. And John, I appreciate you taking it on and being willing to stick with it. Did you actually think we were going to get through all 100, or did you think that you were just signing on for something that would have been dead within like 4 weeks anyway?
I thought that we would have the perseverance to get through the top 100. I didn't think our listeners would, but I'm so happy that they are, because like Phil said, just doing this podcast has led us to the opportunity of watching all these great movies, giving this excuse to watch all these fantastic movies again. And a lot of the times life gets in the way of appreciating art, but having this podcast really gives us the opportunity to step back from life and just indulge ourselves in film. And get to share it with all of you. So we're super happy about that and super thankful that we have this opportunity.
Yep, absolutely. So thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed this. I hope there's some movies in here that you go and check out. You know, we'll be doing our regular podcast again starting in 2022, and we'll be doing our Oscar thing actually not too long from now. The Oscars aren't too far away, which is shocking. I feel like it was just a couple days ago that we had done this. Hope you're enjoying it. And we'll see you all next week. Probably back to our normally scheduled time on Wednesday, I would think, or Tuesday. No, I can't do Wednesday. We'll figure it out. I'll talk to you. We'll figure it out. But we'll be back in 2022. So enjoy all that. And thank you all for listening this whole year.